welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It was Mark Twain who first said, "Truth is stranger than fiction." Indeed it is. Today we'll preview a diverse group of nonfiction selections, true jaw-dropping accounts of Cold War spies, a gang of unlikely arms suppliers, and elite athletes who aim to run a marathon in under 2 hours. In some lighter-hearted fare, we'll sample a new title by a popular comedian who's got plenty to say about cultural stereotypes. My guest today, Ben Mezrich, returns to the Book Report to introduce us to his new book on the Russian oligarchs and the rise of Vladimir Putin. Mezrich's portrait will make you question how our government can go forward with the Russian leader. Let's get started as we turn to page one of the Book Report. From Pulitzer Prize winner David E. Hoffman comes The Billion Dollar Spy, the story of the CIA's most valuable Soviet spy during the last years of the Cold War. While getting into his car on the evening of February 16, 1978, the CIA's Moscow station chief was approached by an unknown Russian. He handed over an envelope whose contents stunned the Americans. Inside were details of top-secret Soviet research and development in military technology, information totally unknown in the U.S. From 1979 to 1985, Adolf Tolkachev, an engineer at a military research center, handed over tens of thousands of pages about advances in aviation technology, alerting the Americans to possible developments years in the future. Tolkachev took enormous personal risks, as did his CIA handlers. With hidden cameras and secret codes, in face-to-face meetings with CIA officers in parks and on street corners, Tolkachev and the CIA worked to elude the KGB. Drawing on previously secret documents obtained from the CIA, as well as interviews with participants, Hoffman reveals how one man mastered the craft of spying against his own nation— until he was betrayed. Dan Warren performs the book.
Over 20 years as the CIA's chief of counterintelligence, from 1954 to 1974, Angleton created an extraordinary mystique about himself and his work. Secretive, suspicious, and tenacious, he became obsessed with the belief the KGB had successfully manipulated the CIA in a vast master plan of deception. He often spoke of a wilderness of mirrors, a phrase he borrowed from T.S. Eliot's 1920 poem, Geronchon, to describe the layers of duplicity and distrust that he believed were being used by the KGB to mislead the West. In 1966, Angleton wrote that an integrated and purposeful socialist bloc had sought to spread false stories of splits, evolution, power struggles, economic disasters, and good and bad communism to a confused West. Once this program of strategic deception had succeeded, the Soviet Union would pick off the Western democracies, one by one. Only the counterintelligence experts, he said, could stave off disaster. Angleton's suspicions permeated the culture and fabric of the CIA's Soviet Operations Division during the 1960s, with disastrous results. Two directors of the CIA, Alan Dulles and Helms, let Angleton have his way. Angleton felt that no one and no information from the Soviet KGB could be trusted. If no one could be trusted, there could be no spies. Counterintelligence is essential for any spy agency to prevent penetration from the same espionage methods it uses against others. In the Cold War, that required a combination of outward vigilance, watching every move of the KGB and deceiving it when possible, and inward skepticism, ensuring the CIA was not swallowing any deceptions or double agents. Ideally, counterintelligence went hand in hand with collecting intelligence, yet there has always been a natural tension between them. A case officer might have painstakingly recruited an agent to produce a fresh stream of positive intelligence, the fruits of spying, only to find a counterintelligence officer raising questions about whether the source could be trusted. The CIA needed both, but Angleton's counterintelligence juggernaut became overpowering in the 1960s. Everything was labeled suspicious or compromised. Angleton's adult life was forged in the world of deception. After graduating from Yale, he became an elite counterintelligence officer based in London for the wartime Office of Strategic Services, the OSS. There, he witnessed the astonishing British deception operation against the Nazis known as Double Cross. The British identified German agents and turned them against the enemy, effectively neutralizing Nazi intelligence collection. After running agents in Italy, Angleton returned to headquarters to become the CIA's chief counterintelligence officer. He believed a massive KGB strategic deception was being played out against the United States. His friendship with Kim Philby might have played a role. In the 1950s, the British MI6 officer had been a confidant of Angleton's. Then, in 1963, Philby was revealed to have been a KGB spy, and he fled to Moscow. The CIA had long suspected Philby, but the confirmation might have been taken by Angleton as more evidence the KGB was on the march, everywhere. The strongest influence on Angleton, however, was Anatoly Golitsyn, a mid-level KGB officer who defected in 1961. Golitsyn spun a vast web of theories and conjecture that reinforced Angleton's suspicions of a KGB master plan to deceive the West. At the CIA, others called it Angleton's monster plot. Golitsyn said that every defector and volunteer to come after him would be part of the master plan. Certainly, the KGB did attempt deceptions, but Angleton pumped fear to new heights. In 1964, he initiated a hunt for a mole inside the CIA to find what Golitsyn asserted were at least 5 and perhaps as many as 30 agency officers or contractors who were Soviet penetrations.
We've just heard The Billion Dollar Spy by David E. Hoffman. Ben Mezrich is the popular author of such bestsellers as The Accidental Billionaires, which was adapted into the Academy Award-winning film The Social Network, and Bringing Down the House, the basis for the hit movie 21. Ben graduated magna cum laude from Harvard and still resides in Boston. Ben is known for creating highly addictive nonfiction, chronicling stories of people on the edge of impossibility, ethics, and morality. Today, Ben stops by to speak about his new title, Once Upon a Time in Russia, The Rise of the Oligarchs, a true story of ambition, wealth, betrayal, and murder. Ben, it's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
How in the world did you hit upon the story for Once Upon a Time in Russia?
Yeah, you know, I never set out to write about Russia. I know very little about Russia normally. But I got a phone call from Brett Ratner, who is the director. He did the Rush Hour movies. He did Tower Heist and Family Man, I think it was. Anyways, he called me up and said, there's these guys in London I want you to meet. They want to tell you a story. So I flew to London. And when I got there, I went to this bar, and there was all this security outside, a lot of big guys with guns. And I went inside, and there was this Russian oligarch there. And he just started telling me this story, and it was just incredible. But my first response was, no way. I don't want to do this. This seems very intense and scary. But as I heard the story, I got really sucked into it and decided to write it.
Well, I hope you were wearing a bulletproof vest and brought your own liquids to drink.
You know, you hear all these stories about polonium poisoning, and it's all in the book. And
right.
How is the people sort of lined up? But in general, this was really a thriller. You know, it's a true-life thriller about these oligarchs who made this incredible fortune in the 90s and were kind of responsible for creating Putin. It's very James Bondy, I think. I just loved writing it.
I'm interested in how the term oligarchs became associated with this group of Russian billionaires.
Well, there really was a small number of people. At one point in time, it was 7 men who controlled 50% of Russia's GDP, which is a spectacular number when you think about it. You talk about the 1% in our country. In Russia, it was literally 7 guys. These were outsiders. These were people from nowhere. Most of them were Jewish in a very anti-Semitic society, so they essentially were under communism, not allowed to have regular jobs. They weren't going to regular schools. And when suddenly the country became capitalist overnight, these were the guys who were in the right position. They were essentially black marketeers, people who kind of knew how to be businessmen, and they worked their way in, and they became billionaires almost overnight.
Tell us a little about Boris Berezovsky.
Boris Berezovsky. So he's the main character of the story. He was a mathematician who was Jewish, wasn't allowed to go to regular schools, and basically when communism fell, he became a car salesman. He started selling cars, and he figured out a way to make an enormous fortune moving cars across the country. They were made around Siberia, and by the time he sold them in Moscow, he was paying pennies on the dollar for them. And he made a fortune doing that, but then in 1994, he was nearly murdered. His car was blown up. His driver was decapitated, and he decided at that point that the only way to stay alive in business in Russia was to involve yourself in politics. So he wormed his way into the Kremlin and became known as the godfather of the Kremlin, and he became this very powerful oligarch. He essentially was the first real oligarch, and that's kind of where my story starts.
And tell us about Roman Abramovich.
So Roman Abramovich was his protege. Roman Abramovich was a 26-year-old guy from Siberia who made children's toys. He was making rubber ducks and you know, dolls. And he met Berezovsky on a yacht in the Caribbean. And he said, I want to, you know, create an oil company. He pitched the idea of putting together these three things, an oil refinery, an oil trading center, and another oil plant. And together, him and Berezovsky privatized this oil company that became the second largest oil company, which was eventually worth $13 billion. They did it with almost nothing up front, and it was using Berezovsky's connections in the Kremlin and Abramovich's connections in Siberia. They were able to do this. And it was almost overnight that Abramovich became sort of the silent oligarch. Nobody really knew anything about it, and he was very secretive, and Berezovsky was kind of the loud, brash one. And together they built this company until Berezovsky, you know, had a falling out with Putin, and that's where it all kind of ended.
What exactly is Kreshia?
So Kreshia is this concept, it's a very uniquely Russian concept, of a roof. The idea is in Russia, a building is held up by the roof, not the foundation. You need a protector. It comes from the mafia. You'd always have sort of a don or someone above you in the mafia who protected you. And in business in Russia, you needed a Kreshia. Berezovsky was Abramovich's Kreshia, and Boris Yeltsin, who was the president of the country, was Boris Berezovsky's Kreshia. So everyone kind of needs a roof. It's not sort of, there's no contracts, there's no forms, there's no shares in a company. It really is just one guy protects the other guy. And Abramovich sort of made this deal with Berezovsky that he would be his roof. And in return, whatever Berezovsky asked for, Abramovich had to provide. So Berezovsky would say, I need $3 million. And they would literally fill suitcases with $3 million in cash and just carry it over to his house and drop it off. So there was all this kind of cash flowing one way for most of their company.
We're speaking with Ben Mezrich on The Book Report. Talk about loans for shares and its impact on the Russian economy.
Sure. So what happened was communism fell, but there was always this threat that communism would come back. And when Yeltsin was in power, he was terrified that he was going to always lose the next election to communism. So he came up with this idea that if we can quickly privatize the whole country, if we can give all resources away to private businessmen, almost overnight, it will make it impossible for communism to come back. So it was actually for good reasons that they did this, but they created this loans for shares system where they essentially allowed people to take loans out on companies without really putting any money up in return for shares in the company they would soon own. So if you were a guy who was becoming an oligarch, you would essentially be able to buy an oil company for nothing. You would get loaned the money in return for shares in the company. So it was really just a connections game, and it led to cronyism. It led to this whole idea that if you knew Yeltsin, if you were part of his family, if you were in cahoots with the Kremlin, you could easily get a hold of a major company.
Tell us more about the unusual transition from Yeltsin to Putin.
Yeah, well, what happened was these oligarchs who were essentially running the country, it was obvious that Yeltsin was dying. You know, he was always sick, he was always drunk, and he was falling apart. And they knew they needed to replace him with somebody. And they wanted to find someone that they could control. They called the idea, they wanted a cog, someone who was just part of the machine. And they found this low-level KGB agent, Vladimir Putin. He was working for the mayor of St. Petersburg. Boris Berezovsky knew him because Berezovsky had tried to set up a car dealership in St. Petersburg and had met this KGB agent there. And they essentially handpicked Putin, and they first placed him as the head of the FSB, which was what the KGB had become. Then he became prime minister. And then Yeltsin was fearing that he was going to lose the election in 2000 at the millennium. So what he did is that on New Year's Eve, he stepped down in this very shocking speech. He basically went in front of the Russian people and said, I'm stepping down and I'm handing the country over to my acting president, Vladimir Putin. And at that point, Putin basically was entrenched and became president almost overnight.
You know, it's so easy for us to poke fun at Putin, his shirtless tough guy image. But after reading Once Upon a Time in Russia, you see he's a guy who stops at nothing, employs any tactic to achieve his ends. Can the West deal with someone who is that ruthless?
Well, I think people underestimate Putin all the time. They think he's someone that is either going to respond well to sort of sanctions, they're going to force the oligarchs to take Putin down. But the reality is it's Putin is the most powerful man in that country, and he's incredibly popular. The Russian people love Putin. So they think, the Russian people believe, all of these sanctions are just the evil West putting pressure on their country, and it just entrenches Putin. It makes him stronger. The oligarchs all work for Putin now. In my book, there's the opening scene, and this really happened right after Putin was elected. He invited all of the oligarchs to Stalin's old house. And he sat them down at a table, and this is the place where you can see bullet holes in the walls where people were lined up and shot. And he said to the oligarchs, you've all made a lot of money, you've all done really well, but from here on out, you stay out of my way. And essentially, that was the moment that Putin took over the country for real. He's the top of the pyramid. The oligarchs can't force Putin out. It's the other way around. Putin can get rid of the oligarchs whenever he wants. He can jail them or have them killed or take their money away. So really, he's an incredibly powerful person. You have to find a way to work with him. There's no way to sort of force him. There's not going to be a revolution in Russia. The opposition is very small, very weak compared to Putin. He's a very, very strong leader. And so you have to find a way to work with him. And, you know, he doesn't want war. He really wants Russia to be incredibly powerful and accepted and respected by the West. I think those are his goals. I mean, he wants the Soviet Union back, but he wants the world to understand that Russia is powerful and to take its place as the most powerful country or the second most powerful country. And so I think you have to deal with that psychology when you're dealing with him.
What are your final thoughts about Once Upon a Time in Russia?
Well, I will say it was an incredible, you know, experience writing this book. It was a little terrifying. We had one meeting where I was sitting with Brett Ratner at this restaurant with his oligarch, and Brett turned to the guy and goes, are we going to get killed for writing this? The oligarch goes, you watch too many movies.
Uh-huh.
And so Brett said, well, what if we say the wrong thing? And he said, don't say the wrong thing.
Oh.
So I feel like, no, I wrote it like a thriller. I think it reads like a thriller. And in the end, I hope people get a new understanding of who these oligarchs were and, you know, sort of ruthlessness, but ambition that led them to where they are.
Well, I know that after reading this book, I'm more terrified of Putin than I had been before. That's a definite.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But, you know, he's not the bad guy in this story. That's what's interesting about it. In the scope of sort of the oligarch story, Putin took over and decided, I'm going to make this country good for Russia. That was his goal. And so by chasing many of the oligarchs out of Russia, by choosing which ones to stay, he was attempting to take the resources and give it back in a way to the Russian people. So in the scope of the story, he's not really the bad guy, but he is ruthless.
All the hits aside and all the murders. Okay,
I mean, you have to accept that there's going to be a lot of murders in this situation.
Right.
You have to equate it to the Wild West in America.
Right.
You know, back in the 1800s, we were shooting each other, too. And that's the way they look at it.
So do you have a kernel for a new book percolating in your brain?
I am. I'm working on a new book and a movie at the same time. Once Upon a Time, Russia is going to be a big movie.
Oh.
Sell it to Warner's, and Ratner's producing it. And then I have another project called The 37th Parallel, which is a book and movie for next summer. And it's about a guy in Colorado who essentially uncovered something very strange in the world of UFOs. But I don't want to give too much of it away.
All right.
But it's called The 37th Parallel.
Oh, well, we'll be looking forward to it, Ben. Thanks again for a fabulously fascinating book, and thanks for stopping by.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All righty, bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of Once Upon a Time in Russia, narrated by Jeremy Bobb.
The silence was excruciating, the minutes ticking by thick and heavy, time itself gorging on the tension in the humid air. Even though the shades had been drawn back from the trio of windows pocking the long plaster walls of the cavernous dining room, it was impossible to tell how deep into the afternoon the day had drifted. The dense forest that surrounded the isolated two-story compound cast deep shadows across the reinforced glass panes, shifting whatever remained of the bright summer light toward an ominous gunmetal gray. For the 18 middle-aged men in dark suits shifting uncomfortably in their seats as they waited in that palpable silence around an oversized dining room table, it was hard to believe that they were still technically within Moscow's city limits. Though, to be fair, this aging, stone house tucked in the middle of the dark woods, surrounded by a pair of chain-link fences topped by barbed wire, was a symbol of a much different Moscow than the rapidly growing metropolis beyond the wire. The men in this room had traveled back in time more than 50 years the minute they had been ushered out of their chauffeured limousines, now parked in glistening rows behind the double fences, and led through the dacha's front door. The setting of the meeting was not lost on any of the men. The invitation that had been delivered by official courier to each of them in the preceding weeks had been met by everything from incredulous laughter to expressions of suspicion. Every soul knew what this place was, whose house this had once been, and what had supposedly taken place here. None of the men looked carefully into the shadows that played across the aging walls, darkening the corners of the vast, high-ceilinged room. Even though this house had fallen into disuse a generation ago and was now more museum than functioning dacha, the meeting's address had meaning far beyond the invitation itself. And the longer the men were forced to wait for whatever was going to happen next, the more ominous the setting seemed. Under the best of circumstances, these men were not accustomed to waiting. To describe them as powerful businessmen or even billionaires would have been a laughable understatement. Among them, they represented the largest and fastest accumulation of wealth in modern history. Within the Russian media, they had garnered the label oligarchs, a term that was usually derogatory, defining them as a class apart and above. According to the popular notion, over the course of the past decade, as the former Soviet nation had lurched into capitalism through a complex, often shadowy process of privatization, this class, the oligarchs, had accumulated insane riches, and they had used this wealth to embed and twist themselves, like strangling vines, into the ruling mechanisms of the nation's government, economy, and culture. Most of the men in this room would have bristled at the designation. If anything, they saw themselves as representatives of the new, free, and modern Russia. Almost all of them had come from poverty. Many had clawed their way out of childhoods filled with deprivation and prejudice. Many at one point had been mathematicians, scientists, or academics before they had turned their ambitions to business. If they had succeeded, and yes, as a group they had succeeded to a degree perhaps unique in history, it was despite the chronic corruption and cronyism of the shifting Russian paradigm, not because of it. Oligarchs or not, men who earned billions were not known for their patience. Eventually, the silence got the better of the room, and one of the invitees, seated closest to the door that led back into the interior of the house, cleared his throat. "If some Chechen managed to get a bomb in here and blew us all to hell," he asked, "do you think anyone would mourn?" Awkward laughter riffed through the room, then trickled away into the shadows. The macabre joke may have hit too close to home. Whatever the men thought about themselves, it wasn't exactly the best time to be a billionaire in Russia.
That was Once Upon a Time in Russia by Ben Mezrich. In The Spy's Son, investigative reporter Brian Denson tells the story of the Nicholsons, father and son co-conspirators who sold national secrets to Russia. Jim Nicholson was one of the CIA's top case officers. By day, he taught spycraft at the farm, the CIA's training center. By night, he was a mini-driving single dad racing home to have dinner with the kids. But Nicholson led a double life. For more than 2 years, he'd meet with agents of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service to turn over troves of classified documents. In 1997, Nicholson became the highest-ranking CIA officer ever convicted of espionage. But his duplicity didn't stop there. While behind bars of a federal prison, the former mole systematically groomed the one person he trusted most to serve as his stand-in, his youngest son, Nathan. When asked to smuggle messages out of prison to Russian contacts, Nathan saw an opportunity to be heroic and to make his father proud. Jason Culp performs the book.
The integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of the treacherous shall destroy them. Proverbs 11:3, The Holy Bible, ASV. Eugene, Oregon, Fall, 2008. The morning of October 10th dawned cold and gunmetal gray in Eugene, a college town so accustomed to autumnal gloom that the young man with sleepy blue eyes gave it scarce notice. Nathan Nicholson hiked across an elevated walkway from his drafting class toward the Lane Community College Library, which sat in the middle of campus in the aptly named Center Building. Behind him, a thicket of towering evergreens carpeted the coastal mountains, which stretched 50 miles west to the Pacific Ocean, clouds draping their rounded shoulders like tattered shawls. Nathan wore his hair razor close on the sides, with a little longer patch on top, a style his barbers back in the Army called high and tight, and which, not by accident, disguised his receding hairline. He moved with an infantryman's gait, chest out, head and shoulders barely rising, stocky legs chewing up ground. But there was a slight hitch in his stride, as if his left leg were stepping over imaginary glass, a parting gift from the parachuting injury that ended his military career. He had turned 24 that summer. The air felt cool on Nathan's face, his strong brow and broad chin, and he could see his breath. The first rains of winter had begun early in the Willamette Valley, where even longtime residents heralded the onset of the soggy season with low-grade despair. Soon would come a monotonous series of drizzles, rolling off the Pacific as if by conveyor belt, delivering the valley so many short gray days that by February, some folks would begin to joke about eating the barrel of the nearest gun. Nathan was not a native Oregonian, and he sometimes missed the more exciting climates of his boyhood. His dad's foreign assignments sent the Nicholson family to punishing places. Manila, with its blistering humidity and electrical storms you could feel under your feet. Bangkok, often called the hottest city on the planet. Kuala Lumpur, where monsoons deliver 100 inches of hard rain a year. And Bucharest, with its pipe-bursting winter freezes. He also missed the rotations, traveling from embassy to embassy, uprooting every few years to start fresh someplace new. Outside the library, Nathan slipped a black and gray alpine backpack off his shoulder and knelt on the cool brick walkway as if to tie his shoe. He hunched over the pack for an instant, letting his eyes casually sweep the commons, panning faces and forms. One intense glance from anyone, and he would bail, circling back later for another try. But he saw nothing suspicious. Nathan unzipped the pack's front compartment and lifted out a small notebook with a blue marbled cover. He flipped through its pages until he reached a 28-word notation that began, "Hola, Nancy." He studied it for a few moments and climbed to his feet, satisfied he could email the message just as the Russian had dictated the previous winter in Peru. His gut was tormenting him again. For many months, stabbing pains deep beneath his breastplate had intermittently doubled him over. He was convinced that the stress of the last year had given him stomach ulcers. His meals bunched in his belly like piles of tacks. He'd seen a doctor at the college's health clinic who told him to drink green tea, carry Pepto-Bismol, and avoid tomato juice. Nathan thought she'd seemed unconcerned, even dismissive of his pains, as if she considered college students exempt from the titanic stresses that produce big boy ulcers. She had not appeared to comprehend the depth of his anxieties, nor could she. There was no way for her to know that for 2 years he had traveled the Americas as his father's agent to Russia's Foreign Spy Service, and now feared he might be under surveillance by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
We've just heard The Spy's Son by Brian Denson. Arms and the Dudes by Guy Lawson is the inside account of how three kids from Florida became big-time weapons traders. In January 2007, three young stoners from Miami Beach won a $300 million contract from the Department of Defense. They were to supply ammunition to the military of Afghanistan. Incredibly, instead of fulfilling the order with high-quality arms, the dudes bought cheap communist-style surplus ammunition from Balkan gunrunners. They secretly repackaged millions of rounds of shoddy Chinese ammunition and shipped it to Kabul, until they were caught by Pentagon investigators and the scandal turned up on the front page of the New York Times. That's the official story. The truth is far more explosive. It's a trip that goes from a dive apartment in Miami Beach to mountain caves in Albania, corridors of power in Washington, and the front lines of Iraq and Afghanistan. The book exposes the murky world of global arms dealing, showing how American military came to use private contractors as middlemen to secure weapons from illegal arms dealers. Jason Culp narrates.
Incredibly, at least according to the official version of events, instead of supplying the Pentagon with high-quality ammunition, Packhouse and Divaroli and Podrisky shipped a mountain of the cheapest possible surplus rounds from arms caches in the Balkans. A story that appeared on the front page of the New York Times in March of 2008 reported that they had the audacity to scam the federal government, supplying faulty, ancient, rusty munitions, cheating the army, and endangering the lives of innocent Afghan soldiers. The Times article made the dudes celebrities of a kind, but it also raised serious questions. How could three so obviously unqualified and inexperienced kids be trusted with such a massive defense contract? How had they fooled so many people for so long? Was the contract typical of the way the world's lone superpower was fighting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? What did the debacle say about America's ability to triumph in the war on terror? As a writer for Rolling Stone, I knew the magazine was always looking for a certain kind of story, tales about young people doing up things, to use the precise words of my editors. The three friends from Miami Beach certainly seemed to qualify. It appeared they might also provide an interesting, even unique, prism into the secretive and mysterious world of international arms dealing. The improbable voyage Packhouse, Divaroli, and Podrisky had taken included geopolitical intrigue, Albanian mobsters, a shady Swiss arms dealer, and an underhanded conspiracy to repackage millions of ancient surplus Chinese-made AK-47 cartridges, all leading to federal indictments for fraud, a congressional investigation, and a scandal that made the U.S. government look not only ridiculous, but incompetent. I knew from experience, this is a trick of the trade, that the best time for a journalist to approach criminal defendants is after they've been sentenced and their legal jeopardy is at an end. So I waited until David Packhouse and Alex Podrisky were about to be sentenced for the federal fraud counts they'd pleaded guilty to. When I contacted Packhouse's attorney, he said his client was willing to meet, so I traveled to Florida. Podrisky wasn't interested in talking at the time. Standing before a judge in Miami's shiny new federal courthouse, Packhouse received a suspended sentence for his role in the Afghanistan contract fraud. Podrisky likewise avoided prison. Their buddy Divaroli wasn't so lucky, sentenced to 4 years behind bars because he was the mastermind of the operation. In court, the government portrayed Packows and Divaroli and Podrisky as low-life fraudsters, three sleazy kids who'd do anything to make money. In the Times, Packhouse's qualifications as a massage therapist played prominently, along with detailed reporting on Divaroli's checkered personal history. The mugshots of Packows and Divaroli that ran in the newspaper made them look like hardened criminals. But in person, David Packows was a surprise. He was smart and well-spoken, a sharp observer of events with a keen memory, an easy laugh, and an ironic appreciation for the absurdity of what he'd lived through. Unlike the Hollywood image of an arms dealer, a soulless thug merchandising death, Packows seemed like the kind of kid who could just as easily have started a dot-com business in Silicon Valley. Instead of inventing a killer app, Packows and his friends had fashioned themselves into gunrunners, precocious, cunning, and astonishingly successful gunrunners. In winning the $300 million contract, three kids from Miami Beach had turned themselves into the least likely arms dealers in history, until their fraud was discovered and the Pentagon turned on them.
That was Arms and the Dudes by Guy Larson. From Gerald Posner, a master chronicler of legal and financial misconduct, comes God's Bankers, an eye-raising investigation 9 years in the making. The book traces the political intrigue and inner workings of the Catholic Church. Decidedly not about faith or religious doctrine, the story focuses on the church's accumulation of wealth and its Byzantine entanglements with financial markets across the world. God's Bankers has it all, a rare exposé and an astounding saga marked by poisoned business titans, murdered prosecutors, mysterious deaths of private investigators, and questionable suicides, a carnival of characters from popes and cardinals, financiers and mobsters, kings and prime ministers, and a set of moral and political circumstances that investigates the church's aims and ambitions. Tom Parks performs a work that is part thriller, part financial tell-all, and a study on how the Vatican has evolved from a fountain of faith to a corporation of extreme wealth and power.
Antonelli soon devised a plan to entirely bypass the Rothschilds. The church would sell interest-bearing debt directly to the faithful without using an investment bank. Two Catholic newspapers offered the chance to test his do-it-alone proposal. In 1861, the Vatican brought the Jesuits' fortnightly La Civiltà Cattolica, Catholic Civilization, to Rome. And it purchased L'Osservatore Romano, the Roman Observer, a paper that became required reading in far-flung Catholic communities. Besides generic articles about faith, Antonelli crammed both papers with appeals for donations. The cash that came in was double his target. The Pope approved the sale of future debt without the Rothschilds. In 1860, the church issued 60 million lira in Vatican bonds. Priests urged the faithful to buy them as their religious duty. Bishops collected the money and sent it to Rome. And when the church eventually needed help managing its debt, Antonelli and Pius ushered in two Paris-based Catholic bankers, the Marquis de la Bouille and Edouard Blount. Free of the Rothschilds, it was not long before Pius rebuilt some of the wall around Rome's Jewish ghetto. Catholics gave money to the church despite Pius's unpopularity. Italians longed for a unified Italy. They knew the Papal States were an obstacle to achieving that. The Pope's likability quotient had also suffered after a widely publicized incident in 1858, in which the papal police in Bologna forcibly seized a 6-year-old boy, Edgardo Mortara, from his Jewish parents after a Catholic housekeeper told friends she had secretly baptized the child years earlier when he had been gravely ill as an infant. Once children were baptized, the church considered them to be Catholic, and therefore Jewish parents could not be trusted to raise them. For centuries, children allegedly baptized in the Papal States had been taken from their birth parents and raised either by a Catholic family or placed into a church-run institution dedicated to the conversion of Jews. What made the Mortara case different was that the youngster's confinement to a Rome conversion center had sparked appeals to Pius personally to intervene and order the boy returned to his parents. Pius instead directed the boy be brought regularly to the Vatican's Esquiline Palace, where he promised to personally raise him as a Catholic. The boy was, of course, awed by the splendor of the papal court, and Pius steadfastly ignored many appeals for his release. Napoleon III, who found it galling that the French garrison made it possible for the youngster to be held, condemned the kidnapping, as did his devout and popular wife, Empress Eugenie. The prime minister of the Italian state of Piedmont, seeing this as an opportunity to weaken the papacy, promised to return the boy to his parents. And Catholics in America and Britain denounced the boy's taking. Pius dismissed the outcry as a conspiracy of free thinkers, the disciples of Rousseau and Malthus. Later, in a reference often used about Jews, Pius chided his critics as dogs and complained there were too many in Rome. When a delegation of Roman Jews visited Pius and pleaded for the boy's release, the Pope erupted in anger, accusing them of stirring up popular sentiment against the papacy. Personal appeals from the Rothschilds went unanswered. La Civiltà Cattolica fed the widely held belief that Jews murdered Christian children in order to use their blood in rituals. It reported Eastern European Jews had kidnapped and crucified children, and suggested that the child's parents wanted him back only so they could torture him, since he was now a Catholic. The paper also published a story about Edgardo's early months in Rome, claiming that he begged to be raised in a Christian home, and that supposedly, without any coaxing, he said, "I am baptized and my father is the Pope." Antonelli knew the impassioned controversy was bad for business. Contributions from the faithful had plummeted due to the international outrage. Antonelli asked the Pope to reconsider, but Pius would not budge. "I have the Blessed Virgin on my side," he told his Secretary of State. "And as for those who might not want to give money to the church because they were alienated by the taking of the boy," Pius told Antonelli that was his job to fix it.
We've just heard God's Bankers by Gerald Posner. Hours to cover 26 miles and 385 yards. It is running's Everest, a feat once seen as impossible. But now we glimpse the mountaintop. In his Spellbinder 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon, Ed Caesar, whose award-winning articles have appeared in Britain's Sunday Times, The New York Times, GQ, and Smithsonian, takes us into the world of the greatest marathoners on earth. Through their stories, he traces the history of the marathon, as well as the science, physiology, and psychology involved in running so fast for so long. Brian Dick performs the book.
As the minutes became seconds, and he towed the Berlin start line in his featherweight Adidas racing flats, he was aware that dozens of less successful athletes depended on him for clothes, accommodation, and transport. He knew his family relied on him for their houses, their food, their televisions, their children's school fees, and their cars. He also knew that in this race he had the chance to win not only €40,000 for the first place and a possible €80,000 in time bonuses, €30,000 for a time under 2 hours 4 minutes 30 seconds, €50,000 more for a new world record, but also, if he won in Berlin, the chance to seal a €500,000 jackpot for winning the cumulative World Marathon Majors prize for 2011 to 2012. And that was just from the organisers of the marathon. His sponsor, Adidas, would also kick in bonuses if he won or became the new world record holder. After agent's fees, he could be more than $500,000 richer by lunchtime. Back home, his friends and family would be huddled around televisions, watching. In these final moments of stillness, however, Mutai banished impure thoughts and the crowding, conflicting voices. He attempted to focus. Psychologists talk about a zen-like state of instinctual action in which the greatest sporting performances are attained. They call it flow. The French cyclist Jean Bobet described a similar but distinct experience called la volupté, which is delicate, intimate, and ephemeral. It arrives, it takes hold of you, sweeps you up, and then leaves you again. It is for you alone. It is a combination of speed and ease, force and grace. It is pure happiness. Mutai has his own term, the spirit. The way he understood it, the brutality of his training regime, 125 fierce miles a week, was endured to attain this sensation. Thousands of hours of suffering for these minutes of sweetness, speed and ease, force and grace. The more harder you train, he would say, the more you get the spirit. It gains on you. So far in his career, the spirit has allowed Mutai the courage to remake the sport of marathon running and to destroy previous conceptions of what was possible, to lose his own fear and implant it in the hearts of his competitors. Now, on this bright, cold day in Berlin, he wished to upend the marathon world once more. As he stood at the head of a vast herd, high banks of loudspeakers began to play the kind of jangling electronic string music you hear in game shows before the host tells a contestant whether he's landed the big prize. Over these shifting arpeggios came the sound of a stout man with a microphone counting down the final seconds before the gun. 10, he shouted in English. 9, 8, 7... Mutai stood still, his chest pushed forward in anticipation of movement. At that instant, the world receded. Mutai became the instrument of a single imperative, to run a marathon in less than 2 hours and 3 minutes. 9 a.m., the gun. The crowd cheered as thousands of electric blue balloons were released into the air. The lead athletes shot off and quickly assembled themselves into a group. Within a few hundred metres, these contenders tucked in behind the four elite pacemakers, wearing black and white striped vests to distinguish themselves, who in turn followed a BMW on which a digital display was mounted showing both the elapsed time and the split time for the last kilometre. In that first group, along with Mutai, were a handful of extraordinary athletes. Dennis Kimetto had been discovered by Mutai in 2008 and now trained in the same group. Nicknamed Mwafrika, or the African, by his fellow athletes on account of his coal-black skin, he had progressed rapidly, breaking the 25-kilometre world record earlier in 2012, and was now running his first marathon outside Kenya.
We've just heard 2 Hours by Ed Caesar. SNL Weekend Update host and stand-up comedian Colin Quinn has just released The Coloring Book, a controversial and laugh-out-loud investigation into cultural and ethnic stereotypes. Colin, who performs the book, has noticed a trend during his decades on the road. Americans' increasing political correctness and sensitivity have forced us to tiptoe around the subjects of race and ethnicity. Colin wants to know, what are we all so afraid of? Every ethnic group has differences, everyone brings something different to the table, and this diversity should be celebrated, not denied. So why has acknowledging these cultural differences become so taboo? Colin takes us on a trip through the insane melting pot of 1970s Brooklyn, the dive bars of 1980s Manhattan, the comedy scene of the 1990s, and post-9/11 America. He mixes his candid and hilarious personal experiences with no-holds-barred observations to decide, at least in his own mind, which stereotypes are funny, which are based on truth, which have become totally distorted over time, and which are actually offensive to each group and why.
Black people showed up in New York City in the early 1920s, in the white Manhattan suburb called Harlem. Before that, black people lived only down south. Until 1963, everybody wanted to be white. Wingtips and whistling big band music on your way to the foundry, slaughterhouse, or brewery. You walked white, tipped your unironic fedora to the ladies, and shook hands with a hearty, "How you do?" Everyone acted white. Even Malcolm X straightened his hair. There was a dress code. No jeans. No sneakers for anyone over 12. You had to wear a shirt and tie if you were a guy. Even on construction sites. Shirt and tie. Hell food was a can of mixed fruit with syrup and food coloring. Then one day, in May of 1964, two soul brothers, as they were known back then, ran into each other on the street. Instead of the usual "hiya, pal, how's tricks?" and a firm grasp of each other's hands, one guy put out his palm and said, "Give me some skin, Jack." And the other guy slapped his palm, and that was that. They changed the greeting. That's kind of a major thing, if you think about it. People are greeting each other all over the country, maybe one out of every three people every day. That's 191.9 million people in the U.S. back then. That's about 64 million greetings a day. And black people changed probably half of those. Black culture then ruled New York City. Before, there had been watch repair, TV repair, shoe repair, clothing repair, even though everybody owned a sewing machine. Suddenly, even my father was wearing a hip, open shirt and growing a beard. People were smoking joints, the Knicks were the stars of New York, and people listened to Gamble and Huff music while wearing giant shoes. I moved to Park Slope when I was 7. Before that, I was in Bay Ridge, then Flatbush, but Park Slope was crazy. Wild white kids, wild Puerto Ricans, but nobody was wilder than the black kids. When us white kids or Puerto Rican kids would steal candy or jump on the back of the buses, we were still scared to get caught and have our mothers find out. But the black kids were not scared of any store owner or bus driver. They'd start yelling back at adults, "Get off me! Tell my mother!" And the store owners wouldn't tell, because they knew if they did, sure they could get a sympathetic woman who thanked them and shook her head and said, "I don't know what to do with him." But they might get the ghetto Avenger mother, who came running in with a string of curses, knocking over the display case and threatening the owner for putting his hands on her kid. Our store owners were all characters. They all had growths or warts or scars and Coke bottle glasses. They were usually either morbidly obese or tubercular. They were prejudiced but not racist. Danny, the Jewish candy store owner, "Hey, you kid, don't jump the line. The colored lady was next. You respect your elders. Now you get to the back. It's the colored lady, the Spanish girl, and the Chinaman, and then you. You learn how to behave." He was a nice guy, and if you asked him what race he hated the most, I bet he would say the Germans first, because he was a Jew that grew up in the 30s. People can be prejudiced against groups based on their experience, not just ignorance. But that doesn't mean they don't like the individuals. Most black people hate, quote, white people as a concept, but they like a lot. Well, some. Okay, a few white people. My first day at IS-88, I was walking down the hall, and a group of black kids were coming from the other direction chanting, "Ungawa, black power, destroy, white boy." I thought, I hope that's not the school song. A lot of white kids in the old neighborhood would use the word "nigger" also, and that didn't make them racist. They even used the word in anger sometimes, even anger towards a black person they knew, and that didn't make them racist either. Oh, you heard me. Using that word wasn't the entirety of people's feelings toward or relationship to the black race. Someone might have an unpleasant interaction with a black person and use the word, and yet at the same time have tons of close black friends who they would die for. Those black friends might hate white people, but they would have white friends who they would die for too. These are contradictions, but most of life is contradictory. There are no absolutes, unless you're an idiot with a naive belief that life is only one way, always and forever. When you're just theorizing about it, absolutes make sense. But when you're living a real life and having actual hot and cold relationships with real people, shit gets complicated.
That was The Coloring Book by Colin Quinn. Oscar Wilde said, "The pure and simple truth is rarely pure and never simple." We'd have to agree. I hope you found some titles today that make you want to crack open the cover and get deep inside the true story. For more titles worth your investigation, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.